Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro, fresh off what he claimed is a successful election victory to create a new assembly, Monday mock targeted U.S. financial sanctions, saying he doesn't take orders from the empire, a reference to the U.S. The government said more than 8 million people took part in Sunday's ballot. The opposition said less than 3 million cast votes, aimed at rewriting the Constitution to give Mr. Maduro sweeping new powers. His defiant Attorney General, Luisa Ortega Diaz, proclaimed the Constituent Assembly not legitimate, calling the election a crime. White House National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster agrees.
You see the end of the Constitution of Venezuela. And this is happening, obviously, at an accelerated pace in recent months over in the Maduro regime. But this is a process that has taken really two regimes to really restrict Venezuelan democracy. By designating Maduro himself, he joins a very exclusive club, including Mr. Mugabe, Bashar al-Assad, and Kim Jong-un, in terms of the brutal repression of his people, and in this case, the abrogation of the Constitution with the Constituent Assembly.
Mr. McMaster said Mr. Maduro is not just a bad leader, he is a dictator. A senior Kenyan election official was found dead Monday, 3 days after he disappeared, and just a week before national elections. Officials said Chris Masondo had been tortured before he died. Electoral Commission Chairman Wafula Chebukati called for heightened security.
In our mind as a commission, the only issue is who killed him and why. And that's a question that must be answered. I demand from the government that they provide security for all employees of IBC for us to give Kenyans a free and fair election.
This is VOA News. Washington said it's reviewing its options after Russia ordered hundreds of U.S. diplomats out of the country in retaliation for new sanctions over Moscow's Ukraine policy and alleged involvement in last year's U.S. election. Many of an estimated 60% of staff are actually locally hired Russians. President Vladimir Putin says there is no sign bilateral relations with Washington are improving. Brookings Institution senior fellow Steve Pfeiffer in Washington said Russia had few options with which to strike back.
Bear in mind what Congress did was action with regards to economic sanctions on Russia that most economists are saying are having an impact that's probably costing the Russian economy about 1% of gross domestic product when you look at American and European sanctions combined.
Vice President Mike Pence in Estonia Sunday expressed hope for better days in relations with Moscow. But Mr. Pence said in Tallinn Monday there is no larger threat to Baltic states than the specter of aggression by Russia. He pledged support for NATO allies Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. He traveled later Monday to Georgia, where troops from the U.S. and other NATO partners are conducting military exercises. He was welcomed by Prime Minister Georgi Kirikashvili.
I have every confidence that the bonds of character, the commitment to independence and freedom, will only grow stronger under your leadership and the leadership of President Donald Trump.
The two men will hold talks Tuesday. Pence then travels to Montenegro, NATO's newest member. The Trump administration Monday said it will begin shipping coal to Ukraine for the first time as the East European country tries to end its reliance on Russia. The agreement between Ukraine's state-run energy firm, Centrinergo, and the Pennsylvania-based Xcoal Energy and Resources is expected to see some 700,000 tons of coal delivered by year's end. Convoys of buses arrived Monday to transfer thousands of Syrian fighters and their families from Lebanon's border into rebel-held territory in northwest and central Syria in exchange for Hezbollah prisoners. A ceasefire agreement was reached last week, ending days of fighting in the mountainous Jerud Arsal region of Lebanon, where jihadists and refugees had been hiding out. In the tiny West African country of Senegal, the ruling Benno-Bok-Yakar coalition claims it won a landslide victory in legislative elections Sunday, bolstering President Macky Sall's bid for another term in 2019. The prime minister said the BBY swept all but three of the country's 45 electoral departments. U.S. stocks hit another record close Monday, the benchmark Dow Jones gaining another 61 points to close at 21,891. New York's three key indices, the Dow, the S&P 500, and NASDAQ, all experienced healthy gains in July. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August 1st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawi police issue an arrest warrant for former President Joyce Banda.
We want to make it very clear to the police, to the government, and to the international community that if there is such a warrant of arrest, Dr. Joyce Banda will avail herself to the Malawi police.
Andikuche Chintuya is a spokesperson for former Malawi President Joyce Banda. Youth groups take to the streets to demand election this year in the Democratic Republic of Congo. We'll talk with an author who says Rwanda's women empowerment is a myth. And Amnesty International calls for an urgent investigation of the murder of a Kenyan election commission official.
This officer's death comes at a very critical time in Kenya's election, which is only a week away from today. And he was at the nerve center of ensuring that the electronic part of this election operates very well and smoothly.
Abdullahi Halaki is Amnesty International researcher for East Africa. We'll examine how social media is changing the landscape of politics in South Sudan, both positively and negatively. And South Africa's economic recession leads to a boom in used book sales. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Former Malawi President Joyce Banda faces arrest if and when she decides to return to the country after several years in self-imposed exile. This after police on Monday issued an arrest warrant for Mrs. Banda over allegations that she abused her office during the so-called Cashgate scandal. Earlier this year, President Arthur Peter Mutharika accused his predecessor of complicity in the looting of public funds. But supporters of the former president say the arrest warrant is yet another attempt by the government to tarnish the reputation of Mrs. Banda. Andikuche Chantuya, spokesperson for former President Banda, tells viewers Peter Clotty that Mrs. Banda is ready to assist in the investigation of the graft allegations.
The information that we have is the same information that you have, that an arrest warrant has been issued. We have not seen a hard copy of the statement, and we have not seen the warrant of arrest. I was personally at the police headquarters today so that I can actually see the actual warrant of arrest, or at least the statement. I was just being thrown about from one office to the other, so I've come back without actual confirmation. And I was trying to get confirmation even just of the existence of such a warrant.
A Malawi online newspaper published the arrest warrant issued. So it is odd for somebody to think that the Malawi police have failed to officially present the arrest warrant to her lawyers.
Yes, and they are aware of where to find us. I mean, we've communicated with them on several other issues. So everyone would know where to find us, but they have not. But we want to make it very clear to the police, to the government, and to the international community that if there is such a warrant of arrest, Dr. Joyce Banda will avail herself to the Malawi police. I don't think it's necessary for them to start organizing so that they can try and go and arrest her or look for her wherever she is. If they just show us the warrant of arrest, Dr. Joyce Banda will come and present ourselves and honor whatever warrant is there.
But some Malawians are saying that the former president has refused to return to Malawi for fear of arrest because of this Cashgate controversy that she is alleged to have committed. And that is why she's exiled herself and they want to be away from the arms of the law from the Malawi police. What do you say to that?
For the past 3 years, the police or no court order or no government agency, whether it's ACB, no one has asked to interview her, to speak to her, to explain anything. So there has been no reason why she would say she is running away from this country, or anyone to say she is running away from this country. Even in the Cashgate cases, there were 72 people that were arrested by the JB government, the Joyce Banda government. Of all these, none of them has mentioned Dr. Joyce Banda as a strategist, a participant, accomplice, or as a beneficiary of Cashgate. Actually, the problem is that the current president tries to compare himself on the international scene with Dr. Joyce Banda, and unfortunately, he doesn't compete well.
Are you therefore saying
yes,
the alleged charges being brought against Joyce Banda about corruption concerning the Cashgate matter is all due to political calculation and machinations by President Atapita Mutharika and the government just to undermine the reputation of former President Joyce Banda on the international scene?
Yes, that is exactly what I am saying. And I don't know if you're aware that 3 days ago, the president actually complained that Dr. Joyce Banda is tarnishing his image globally. Now we don't understand because this is coming like 3 days or 4 days later when there's been 3 years that they could have done something about this. And again, this is being done when it's 2 years of an election, when Dr. Joyce Banda is already scheduled to come. So Dr. Joyce Banda was already scheduled to come here this August, but now they are doing this. Maybe they have information that she's coming back. And they're trying to change her image because they're looking at 2019 elections.
And Kuche Chantunya is the spokesperson for former Malawi President Joyce Banda. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from the commercial capital, Blantyre. Amnesty International has called for an urgent and thorough investigation of the murder of Kenyan Election Commission official Chris Umsando. Umsando was head of information, communication and technology at the Kenyan Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission. His body was discovered Saturday after he had gone missing for 3 days. Kenya's Election Commission Chair, Fafula Chibukati, reportedly said Umsando had been tortured. Kenyans go to the polls August 8 to elect a president, and the election is suspected to be close. Abdullahi Halaki is Amnesty International researcher for East Africa. He said there is a real danger that a crisis could erupt if authorities do not ensure that Kenyans can cast their ballots free from intimidation, threats, and violence.
I think the most important thing here from Amnesty International is his disappearances and eventually being taken to the mortuary and saying that he was murdered, I think needs to be thoroughly investigated, and those who are involved should be made to account for it. But again, the most important thing that we need to remember is this officer's death comes at a very critical time in Kenya's election, which is only a week away from today. And he was at the nerve center of ensuring that the electronic part of this election, and that is the ICT infrastructure, operates very well and smoothly. And he's been on the media explaining how that does.
Abdullahi, of course, the 2007-2008 post-election violence is still on the minds of many Kenyans and many of us who follow those elections. This murder is perhaps bringing back those memories.
Indeed, I mean, the ghost of 2007-2008 casts a big shadow over how Kenyans are conducting this election, never mind that these events took place 10 years ago. It just shows how intense Kenyans' elections are generally. It also demonstrates that this particular election is very close, and therefore people are looking up to these institutions for leadership. So therefore, it is very distressing at this moment, 1 week to the election, that such a high-profile individual who was meant to play a critical role is disappeared. First, a few days later, he's said to be killed. And that is why we are calling for a thorough, and open, and transparent investigation by the Kenyan authorities.
And also, given the kind of role he was playing on the Elections Commission, besides investigating, it probably raises questions about the credibility of the elections themselves that are coming.
That is without a doubt. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the media appearances that the late Chris has been making, explaining all the details and the minutiae of the elections. So he was obviously somebody who was well-versed with the electronic system that, you know, we are embarking on because people feel that it's more foolproof than, let's say, you know, other methods of voting. So that shows that there is already an inbuilt mistrust of the institution. And so mechanisms of addressing that are put in place. The person who is in charge of that process is killed. You can see why it makes, you know, a lot of people a bit worried, a bit not sure how these elections will go. So therefore,
That is the context. 2007, 2008, 10 years ago when we had electoral violence because of disputed elections. In between that, we've had 2013 election where the opposition felt that the election was not free and fair. As a cure to that, several steps have been put in place, including having an electronic voting mechanism. So you can see why this raises serious doubts about the conduct of the election.
Abdullahi, it's so nice to talk with you. Thank you very much again.
Anytime. Have a good one. Take care. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Abdullahi Halake is the Amnesty International researcher for East Africa. You're speaking with me from Kenya's capital, Nairobi. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, the first day of August, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. Police in the Democratic Republic of Congo have detained at least 50 people in the northeastern part of the country amid demonstrations organized by the Lucha Youth Movement to demand the government release the electoral timetable and hold the polls this year as agreed to in the December 31st accord. Mohamed Yusuf has the story from VOA's East Africa Bureau in Nairobi, with reporting in Goma by Austere Yalala Malivika Joseph.
Protesters barricaded the main road in the eastern DRC city of Goma with stones. In neighboring towns of Bukavu, Butembo and Beni, similar protests were held. Demonstrators were demanding the country's electoral agency announce an election date. The protests come days after the United Nations called on Democratic Republic of the Congo President Joseph Kabila to hold elections before the end of 2017. The spokesman for the Lucha Youth Movement in Goma is Justin Muhiwa.
Ndio wafanye kalendari ya uchaguzi kwa sababu hawawezi endelea kutuacha kwa giza.
He says the Electoral Commission needs to set the election date because it is the right of Congolese to vote in this election. Police used tear gas to disperse protesters and also rounded up dozens of young people. Lucha, which has 1,000 members across the country, organized the latest protest. Kabila's constitutional mandate to rule Congo ended last year, and he cannot run again for the presidency under the political deal with the opposition signed last year, but can lead the state until the election is organized. Many Congolese fear the president is not willing to step down as planned, and recently the Electoral Commission has said it cannot organize polls this year. One Goma resident was not happy the political direction his country has been taking recently. He says for democracy to prosper, there must be an election. The people are struggling and not happy about the direction the country is taking. He adds, there is no one fighting for them. Kabila's government has faced a wave of protests in the past couple of months, calling for it to step down and respect the deal signed last year, demanding the election be held. The youth group Lucha says it plans to continue demonstrations until an election is held. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Rwandans will cast ballots for president on August 4th this week, and President Paul Kagame is running for a third term. If he wins, he could remain in power until 2034. This will be the country's third election since the 1994 genocide. Rwanda has been praised for having the world's highest percentage of women in parliament. Helen Epstein is a professor of public health and human rights. She is also co-author of an article entitled Rwanda's Elections and the Myth of Women's Empowerment. She says this rosy picture of Rwanda masks a terrifying repressive program of which many courageous women have been victims.
We're often told that people in Rwanda must make a kind of bargain, that they have to surrender certain political and civil rights. But in return, the government is very progressive on promoting the well-being of women and children. They're more than half of parliament, for example, comprises women parliamentarians, and rates of maternal and infant mortality are said to be have fallen very steeply in the past 20 years. So in many ways, the country is portrayed as a kind of paradise for young women, but that's only part of the story. There's another side of the story, which actually is much darker.
When you say much darker, what do you mean? I mean, well, Rwanda is praised by many countries.
Yes, and yet it's only a certain kind of politics. It's only politics as far as it conforms to what the ruling party would like. So, for example, any criticisms of the party, whether they are voiced by men or women, are met with a very severe crackdown. And in some ways, in recent years, women government critics, women journalists, women politicians, and others have really borne the brunt of the regime's ire in response to any sort of dissent. For example, most recently in the forthcoming election that is going to take place in a couple of days, President Paul Kagame faces a number of challengers, and the most formidable one was a young woman named Diane Rwigara. So she was raising all of these issues and has had a terrible time. Many of her supporters were jailed, harassed, disappeared for a period of time. I think some of them have turned up. Most of them have reappeared, but they were in jail.
You brought up the issue of Ms. Diane, I think, Rwigara. As I mentioned, I spoke to an official of the Rwandan Elections Commission and brought up that issue that she was disqualified by the Elections Commission because the government feared her. And the Elections Commission official told me that Ms. Rwigara was disqualified because she failed to gather the 600 signatures on the national level that were required by the Elections Commission.
That's highly disputed. For example, she actually submitted about 1,000 names to the Electoral Commission, and the Electoral Commission disqualified more than 400 of them. So there does seem to be a need for some independent evaluation and perhaps an audit of the signature process in the country.
So it seems to me your article, perhaps you're talking about also the fact that while Rwanda may have this name of having more women participation in government, perhaps it does not speak to how much power these women really have. Do they have enough power?
It doesn't seem to me that anyone in Rwanda has much power except for the president and the small circle of supporters around him. This is the problem. It really is a very profound dictatorship. And it doesn't matter what gender you are, really, in that country. You are not free to speak your mind.
Helen Epstein is professor of public health and human rights at Barr College in New York State. She is also the co-author of an article entitled Rwanda's Elections and the Myth of Women's Empowerment. She was speaking with me from New York. Social media sites like Facebook and Twitter have become a powerful medium in promoting hate as well as encouraging moral behavior. Xie Deng takes a look at how the social media has changed the landscape of politics and ignited discourse, both constructive and destructive, among South Sudanese at home and in the diaspora.
Many South Sudanese diaspora with access to internet and smartphones say they're making good use of social media to promote peace. But a survey by the United States Institute of Peace found out that some South Sudanese use the platform to voice their grievances through inflammatory language and images. Gordon Boy is the deputy chief of mission at the South Sudan Embassy in Washington and is responsible for council and diaspora affairs. Boy has gotten attention for some of his controversial posts on Facebook. The UN panel of experts on South Sudan identified Boy as one of the prominent South Sudanese who use Facebook to post inflammatory messages. Boy says his Facebook posts are defending the South Sudan government.
For example, in March, if you heard about it, there were groups in America who wrote in the social media that Salva Kiir died, and then there was a war between Paul Malong and Kwame Nyong'o on succession. I think you heard about it. All the shops in Juba were closed, and Salva Kiir had to come out to show to the people that, oh, I'm alive, I'm not dead.
But Boy has posted several messages on his Facebook page about Riek Machar as well. In 2016, he alleged that Machar could no longer see with his right eye. In one of his posts, Boy claimed that one of Machar's legs was amputated and he was in a coma. In addition, Boy posted pictures of Riek Machar and his wife, Angelina.
Because people in the diaspora, they use social media And we have to use social media in order for them to have information which is accurate, not the fake ones, because there are so many fake news in the social media regarding South Sudan.
Some activists use Facebook for a different purpose. Groups like Anataban and the South Sudan We Want post videos that combat online hate speech. Jacob Bull, a member of Anataban, says most of the online hate speech is generated by members of the diaspora.
People in diaspora are disconnected to what is happening back home. So whatever information you get from any source that you get it, or maybe from social media, you think that is a positive, that is the real message. But if you get down deep to, trying to filter this message that you get and get deep into knowing the exact information, then at some cases you'll get it's a false information.
South Sudan politician Pagana Moom says he was a victim of hate speech. He says he was portrayed as a rapist and murderer. Pagan sued the woman in the United States who abused him online. Amoom says some posts on social media can be very harmful.
It ceases to become a free speech and become a hate speech when the content is inciting violence, is demonizing and dehumanizing persons for whatever reasons that they aim. Either they aim to destroy them or they want to justify committing crimes against them.
Peace Tech Lab, an initiative of the United States Institute of Peace, conducted research to identify sources of hate speech. The research found the diaspora as the main perpetrators of hate speech. The research notes that both sides to the conflict have used hate speech to incite violence. For VOA News, I'm Cher Deng from Washington.
South Africa entered an economic recession in June, and the country's unemployment rate is fast approaching 30%, according to the government statistics agency. But for the sellers of second-hand books, business has never been better. Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
Then we have travel. Well, travel section, and then we have Afrikaner fiction. Books about Africa, but fiction like Jock of the Bushveld might be one of them, or Bosman, or those kind of books. Which is basically books about Africa.
Eric Norfolk shows a customer around his store in Johannesburg. He's been selling used books for almost 30 years. Norfolk says he recently faced intense competition before launching his fifth bookshop in the city.
And my ex-wife also wanted to open up a shop in this area, but I beat her to the punch, so she's a bit pissed off with me, actually.
He says establishing the new branch is one of the best decisions he's made.
I'm making money and it's going into my third month, and that's pretty good for a new business to make money so quickly. Books have come back.
It's a big contrast to 5 years ago when Nofel sales dropped dramatically. Book lovers were embracing electronic reading devices like Kindles. He had to close 6 stores. But now Nofel says the Kindle craze may be over and many South Africans want to turn real pages. Yet many of his clients give another reason for no longer buying new books.
They've gone up a hell of a lot. Obviously, it depends on your import or your rand level.
The rand has dropped steadily against the dollar since the end of 2011, when $1 was valued at about 8 rand. Presently, a dollar is valued at 13 rand.
A new book should cost you about the price of a meal. In the UK, that's about right. A meal costs about £7 and a book costs about £7. Yeah, on the other hand, a reasonable meal for one person will cost you about 70 rand, 80 rand, and a book costs 350. People just can't afford books.
Dealers across Johannesburg put the number of second-hand bookstores at about 50, up from about 25 just a few years ago. But used books are not always cheaper. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And that's it for this Tuesday, August 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Greg Burns, I am James Barton in Washington saying, have a nice day, Africa.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.